Are you about to launch a WordPress site? Make sure you have everything ready to go, including design, SEO, and security, with WP Engine's ultimate pre-launch checklist for WordPress sites. Download it free at wpengine.com/pre. That's wpengine.com/pre.
You want to bet on your freedom, not on your slavery. I have a couple of outfits. I have a computer, I have an iPad, and a phone. You know, what else do I ever really need? Doing things is how you get things done. Always try to figure out where is the time that you could spend.
This is Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. This week, we're talking to James Altucher. I assume he doesn't need an introduction for many of you, but for the rest, James is currently known best for his book, Choose Yourself, which is a national bestseller and which USA Today named in the top 12 business books of all time. You can buy Choose Yourself at cadavy.net/choose. He also has a very popular podcast. The James Altucher Show has featured guests such as Tim Ferriss, Dan Ariely, Peter Thiel, Coolio, and Jewel. James has published well over a dozen books and first made his name as a financial pundit writing for the Financial Times and TheStreet.com. He's also appeared many times on CNBC as a financial expert. James has become a millionaire, then lost it all multiple times. He's been an entrepreneur, a hedge fund manager, and even hosted an HBO show. He writes about what he's learned through the ups and downs of his life and career on his website, jamesaltucher.com. Popular articles include How to Be the Luckiest Guy on the Planet in 4 Easy Steps and I Want My Kids to Be Drug Addicts. Listen to this conversation to learn the hows and whys of investing in yourself, including why buying a house may be a terrible decision for you. James and I will also talk about our recent experiences with going minimalist. He has a method for getting rid of things that I really wish that I would have used.
That's why I had to go away and someone had to come in and I just said, get rid of everything. And she left that place spotless.
I also really wanted to dig into how James has managed to be so prolific in his work. He produces a ton of work. It seems like he rarely doubts any of the ideas that he has. It seems like it's always been that way for him, which doesn't help much if you're struggling to be more courageous in your work. If you're someone like me who wasn't born thinking big, James will share some tips on how to make progress.
There's nothing they can think. There's no way to change their thinking that will help them, but they can do things. Practice doing things, not just thinking about things. You do things in little bits and pieces. You start off small and you get bigger and bigger.
As someone who has learned a lot from reading James's writing, I was also excited to learn more about how he approaches writing. James is going to share some absolute gold on writing that has already helped me make my own writing connect with others better.
Writing skill really is all about digging deeper until you hit that vein of honesty inside yourself. If it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. Like, real writing is about you know, being transparent and open and having a conversation with the world that's real and not fake.
Also learn how my former neighbor, Warren Buffett, chose himself. And if you happen to be a podcaster too, I selfishly asked James how he connects with influential guests and how he prepares for interviews. So even if you aren't a podcaster, his answers, of course, could help you connect with influencers and help you get more out of the books that you read. There's so much more in this fantastic conversation with James Altucher. Here's the whole interview. When you're billing your clients, the last thing you want to waste your time and mental energy on is creating invoices. FreshBooks customers get paid an average of 5 days faster. Get your free 30-day trial at cadavy.net/freshbooks. I'm here with James Altucher, and James, I think that the thing that most people are familiar with is your book, Choose Yourself, and it's definitely the thing that had the most impact on me personally. So I'm curious, what was the point at which you started to realize that you should be choosing yourself?
Tomorrow.
That's when you first realized.
Yes, because it's one of those things where you write a book where it's the thing you write a book about the thing that's hurting you the most. Yeah. It's like if everybody writes these books, 10 ways to be a leader, or you know, the code of the I don't want to make fun of anybody. You know, how to be the smartest person in the universe. I want to know the hardships along the way to getting them to come to this realization or this amazing knowledge that all these authors supposedly have. The reality is we're all kind of just struggling and trying to figure it out. And I'm trying to figure it out too. And choosing yourself, as I call it in the book, is a daily process. This idea that you don't need validation from others, that you can kind of succeed on your own, that you can find the inner strength on your own to succeed. This is an ongoing process. It's not something I hope tomorrow I wake up and still feel like this need of not having to be validated, but I know I have to struggle with it every day.
For me, like when I first started reading that book, I felt like you had been following me or something, because I remembered back when I first graduated from college and I had my first job in like 2003, and I was living in Omaha, Nebraska, and my boss would come to my desk like almost every single day and say, "Oh, when are you going to buy a house? It's the best investment you can make." And it always, to me, sounded like I felt like I was in a Mike Judge movie, or like I was in The Office Space or something the whole time. I was just like, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. I'm 23 years old. The best investment I can make is in myself. And I wish that book.
Just think about that. Like in Omaha, I don't know what housing prices cost. Let's say for a decent like two bedroom house, $200,000. So you'd have to put down, I don't know, 30%, you know, to be safe. So you put down $60,000 and you're 23 years old. You're 23 years old. You're going to suddenly put down $60,000 and go $140,000 in debt. And by the way, it has negative yield as opposed to like something else, which has positive yield. There's additional maintenance, property taxes, and you know, the maintenance is unpredictable. It's volatile. So you never know how much you're going to need to spend on it every year.
Yeah, and I mean, I didn't know all of that. It just felt very strange to me, and I'm really glad that I didn't take that plunge, because obviously a few years later, all my friends were like, "Oh, I would love to move, but I can't because, you know, I'm in the hole on this house. I owe money on this house that I live in," and things like that. And you're going to say something?
No, it's just that's exactly right, that you know, the other cost that people don't consider is that you become chained to the land that you buy.
Right. Well, and then
by the way, you don't own that land. The bank still owns $140,000 worth of it. So you never, and the government owns it if you don't pay your property taxes. So you never really own it anyway.
And so, yeah, actually the thing that I ended up doing instead, I was getting paid like $13.50 an hour or something. I was a college graduate. But I was like socking away as much money as I could in the stock market, and fortunately the timing was good. I was putting it in Google and Apple, and so then when I got a job in Silicon Valley and I could move there, I had the mobility. I didn't have to like sell a house or something like that, and that was what was of value to me, especially at that age, where it was that I had the flexibility. I could go just move across the country and be in a different place where I would be exposed to smart people that were challenging me.
Yeah. So you want to make the decisions that are more inclined to allow for future freedom. You want to bet on your freedom, not on your slavery.
Yeah. How do you think it is that people have? How do you think it is that people miss out on seeing that?
Because the brain has a cognitive bias that if you make a big decision, your brain's going to refuse to let you think that you made a wrong big decision. And maybe among the biggest decisions in life are, at least the biggest financial decision you're going to make in life is buying a house. So you have so many people around you, like your boss in this case, who made that big financial decision. And he's so afraid that he made the wrong decision, but his brain's like, no, you made the right decision. Why don't you convince everyone else to make the same decision you did? So it's not even like his fault, but his brain and the brains of everyone around you who made the same decision, they're all trying to push you to join them in this secret club to reaffirm that they made the correct decisions themselves.
Yeah, and in all fairness to him too, he was like, you know,
in his
50s.
Not in all fairness to him.
He was like in his 50s, you know, he owned a business. Like he wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't necessarily a bad idea in his case to buy a house. Do you feel that way at all, or you disagree with that?
I don't know. Maybe he wanted to leave his life and leave his wife and run around naked in some other country and
he missed out on that opportunity because he had the stupid house.
Yeah, we don't know anything about him.
Oh, that's true.
Other than that, he literally took handcuffs and chained himself to a tree in a house in Omaha, Nebraska.
And, you know, I recently was reading about how you, like, kind of got rid of everything as well recently. Was that something that was a freeing experience for you? But did that feel like choosing yourself to you?
No, not really. I mean, it was something that I felt like I wanted to do, but people asked me afterwards if it was freeing, and to be honest, it feels like it should have been, but I was already living a life of not using any of those things, so I figured, okay, if I'm not using or looking at the, if you only look at something once every 5 years, like let's say, I don't know, sheets for guests, then you don't need it. You can throw it out, and you can buy the sheets when you need them.
That also go ahead.
I realized I was living in an Airbnb at that point for almost a year straight. I was living in different Airbnbs. So I didn't really need anything that was in the house I was renting, and my lease was coming up. So I said, I don't need to keep doing this lease, and I don't really need anything in this house. So I hired somebody to just go and clean out the house.
Okay, that's a really smart thing, because I actually recently sold almost everything. I got it down to a few suitcases. But for me, I'm in Colombia. I had to fly back to Chicago, and it took me 6 weeks to sort through everything. And there were certain things I wanted to digitize, and then there were certain things getting rid of things on Craigslist and selling things on Amazon. And it was really like it was a real pain in the ass. I'm glad to have it done, but that sounds great to just have somebody else take care of it. How did you manage that whole process?
Well, I said to a friend of mine who kind of needed the money that, here's the address, go to my house. You can either throw anything out, keep anything, sell anything, donate anything, do whatever you want, take your family. She took cousins, brothers, sisters, husband, children, and she went and took computers, paintings, beds, sheets, furniture, dishes, you know, food, I don't know, anything that you could imagine being in a house. I lived in that house for five years at that point. So I had 5 years worth of stuff, plus let's say 20 years worth of stuff that had been following me around from house to house before that, or 40 years worth of stuff in some cases. And she just got rid of everything. I told her, don't call me at all during the whole process. And she called me once to ask if I wanted to get rid of my diploma. And I said, no one's ever asked me for my diploma in the past 20 years. So just get rid of it. That's the last thing I want around. And she got rid of it.
Yeah, I guess I wimped out on that one. I sent my diploma to my parents. So it's...
What are they going to do with it?
I don't know. Maybe like make spit wads out of it or something. I'm not sure.
And then when you die, do you have kids?
No, I don't.
Well, what's going to happen when you die to all your stuff?
Well, then they're going to have to clean out my house full of stuff. And actually, my parents have gotten more minimalist over the years too, just because my mother had to clean out different relatives' houses after long periods of times, and then eventually, I think, decided like, oh God, I don't want other people to have to do that for us. But they have a decent amount of stuff as well. But that's a good idea, having somebody else do it, because it was actually, at times, it was like an emotionally draining experience just sorting through all of the things, because the objects that we own have like these stories associated with them. And like you were saying, there might be this thing that you didn't even know existed, and then you open it up, and then suddenly you're like, oh God, I don't know, can I really like throw out my paper photos from when I was a kid or when I was in college or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. If you start going through your stuff yourself, you're doomed. That's why I had to go away, and someone had to come in, and I just said, get rid of everything. And she left that place spotless. Like, I ran into my ex-landlady a few weeks ago, and she said, boy, you left that place like it was brand new. So it was great. I would never would have done that myself. I'm not such an organized, clean person. So it was great for me to do this in every way.
As you were going through that process, you were getting rid of everything. Did you ever at any moment think like, oh gosh, am I crazy? What am I doing?
No, never. Because what was I missing? Like, I wasn't missing anything from all those years. Like, I had no use for anything.
Well, that's
what do you really have use for on a daily basis? I have a couple of outfits. I have a computer. I have an iPad and a phone. I live near a bookstore, so if I want to read like a hardcover book, I have no problem.
Yeah.
What else do I ever really need?
Well, yeah, I mean, I get it. Like, logically, it makes total sense, right? But as somebody who has recently been through this experience, I've certainly found it difficult to be like, oh gosh, I can't believe I'm like getting rid of all of my stuff. And, you know, obviously, like a lot of people around you, whether it's from their own fear or something, might make their own conclusions about what's going on. And so what is it sort of emotionally that's going on differently in somebody who can just get rid of all their stuff and not have any sort of existential crisis about it? And then the people who think, gosh, I could never do that. Or if somebody else is doing that, they think that person's crazy. Or did you get any of that? Anybody?
Yes, I got a lot of that. And I also got some backlash, like, oh, he's not really being a minimalist. Like, who cares? I wasn't labeling myself one way or the other. It was just something for me. It wasn't really, and I wrote about it, so I guess that makes it for public consumption, but I did it for me, something that was important to me, not really to make an example or live out a particular life philosophy or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is something that I want to figure out about you, James, is that just going through all the things that you've done. You started that web design company in the 90s, and you sold it for a bunch of money. You worked for HBO for a while, and you were like interviewing prostitutes at 3 a.m. and brought a company public, I believe, or at least very close to it, if I'm getting that right. And it seems like you all the while have sort of thought big and not really questioned yourself. But I think that what holds a lot of people back a lot of times is, one, they don't think big. And then if they do start thinking big, then they start to question themselves. So I'm wondering, is this like an inherent thing to you? Or was there any particular period of time where you didn't think that way and you started to?
I think I don't think that way as much now, and I wish I did a little bit. Like, I think I was always thinking really big and that nothing could get in my way. I always thought, if you do the right things, anything is possible, which sounds kind of corny because it is, because it's this sort of thing young people think when they're more likely to take risks. And I still think, I think I still kind of think that way, but I think I'm a little more cautious now, which has its good points. Which is that I probably won't lose as much money now. And it has its bad points in that I don't try as many things now.
And did you think that way when you were a kid? Were you doing...
I always thought I could do anything. I mean, I was in second grade writing books that I thought were going to get published and be bestsellers. So I always kind of thought that nothing stood in my way.
Do you have any theories about how you turned out that way?
I haven't really thought about it. I guess my parents were always very encouraging, but, I just had a big ego about stuff. I think you kind of have to be willing to try anything. I mean, look, there's plenty of time to try anything. So trying something, like for instance, I started a company once and it involved spending a morning, just one morning, writing a business plan and then emailing it to some people. And then some people got interested and they emailed it to some people and those people got interested and suddenly I was writing a more formal business plan and raising money. So it really just took a morning of a couple of hours to write a business plan on an idea that got some interest. Now, there's plenty of times, plenty of mornings I've spent where nobody was interested, but I forget about those, and I remember the ones when it worked. You know, when you want to light a match, sometimes you have to hit the match several times against the matchbox before it lights on fire.
Yeah, I guess I'm looking for that thing that, like, I think that it just wouldn't dawn on most people to go ahead and write a business plan and email it to a bunch of people. And it seems like that comes really naturally to you. So I'm wondering for, like, a person who isn't thinking that way, is there anything that they can do to start thinking that way?
Well, you phrased the question correctly. Is there anything they can do? Because the answer is yes. There's nothing they can think. There's no way to change their thinking that will help them, but they can do things. So, for instance, a few months ago, I wanted to write a children's book. Now, for me, I'm not an illustrator, no problem, but I wrote the children's book and I sent it to an illustrator and said, "What do you think?" And she said, "This is fantastic. Can I illustrate it?" And so I said, "Sure." And so now we have a children's book coming out in a month, about a month. So that's how things get done. How long did it take me to write the children's book? Not too much time. A children's book's pretty easy to write. Now, will it be good? I have no idea. Maybe the next one will be good, or the third one. But doing things is how you get things done.
I have a theory about this. I think I have a theory because I feel like I've been somebody who didn't necessarily do everything that they thought about doing or fantasized about doing, and I'm not perfect at that, but something I work on. But I feel like there's a lot of people have these little glimpses of ideas or dreams or fantasies in their heads, and then it just goes right over them. They don't realize that the thing that they just fantasized about is something that they could actually go ahead and do.
Well, I fantasize a lot of things also, and some things I can't do. But, you know, if you have, make sure you leave open space in your life. I mean, I have a friend who had a 9-to-5 job, which meant he had to wake up at 6 in the morning, get on the train at 7. He wouldn't get home till 7. Then he had to spend time with kids. And he kept thinking to myself, well, where is the time in my life to do what my real dream is? And he, on the train ride going into the city, his commuting ride, he noticed everybody would either be sleeping or reading the paper or whatever. So he would write a page a day on a novel, and he wrote a best-selling mystery novel. It took him about a year, and he wrote a best-selling mystery novel. So always try to figure out where is the time that you could spend. Well, people might say, oh, well, I'm so tired. I really need the time to sleep or to catch up on the news. You don't really need to do that. So you can write 300 words of a mystery novel on the train to work, or do whatever it is you want to pursue. Send an extra email a day. I always say to people, come up with 10 ideas a day, because maybe one or two of those ideas every 1,000 or so might be decent ideas that are worth pursuing. You don't want to pursue every idea because that would be too busy, too much. But, you know, you might get excited about one or two ideas a year.
By the way,
You follow a lot of ideas. You said you're from Omaha, Nebraska, but now you're sitting in Columbia, 5,000 miles away from there, doing a podcast with me, and I'm 6,000 miles from you. So you're doing what the heck happened? You're doing this amazing science fiction thing right now.
We're looking at
each other. I know you're just doing the audio, but we're doing this via video. We're looking at each other across 6,000 miles. We've never met before. This is like Star Trek.
Well, I agree, but and so the reason why I'm digging into it for you is because for me it took a lot of facing fears, and it took a lot of emotional change, and it took a lot of recognizing when people around me were saying things should be one way, recognizing that whatever feeling I had that, like, oh, this doesn't make any sense, that was those were thoughts worth thinking. And so there are a lot of barriers to go through to end up this way. So I guess I'm trying to pull out if there were any of that for you.
So the question is, practice doing things, not just thinking about things. So let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. How did you just suddenly quit your job and move from Omaha to Columbia? Like, what happened?
Okay, so first of all, some crazy entrepreneur from Silicon Valley sort of discovered me out of the blue. And he would come into town every once in a while, and I ended up being his designer for his startup. And eventually he hired me, and I moved out to Silicon Valley. And then I was out there for a few years. And then I realized I didn't really like the whole VC-backed startup thing. So I moved to Chicago, and I lived there for 8 years. And then I ended up writing a book that came out like 5 years ago that was on design. And then eventually I was going winters in Columbia. And
Hold on a second. So you're at your shitty little job in Omaha, and some guy discovered you. He liked some design you made, and he asked you to do a design for him, presumably as a test. He didn't just say move to San Francisco. He said, right, do some design for me. And you did some. You did a design for him, maybe more than one. How many did you do for him for free?
It took us, oh, it wasn't for free even. It was, he was actually, I used him as a client through the architecture firm that I was working at. And it took like 6 months to do like a logo, basically a logo.
So you were doing stuff for him.
Yeah.
And then finally he said, why don't you move to California? And he offered you a job or whatever. And so you had the experience of moving. And then you realize, well, I could do this design stuff from anywhere, because you had just been doing design from Omaha for a guy in San Francisco, so you could live anywhere. So you moved to a cheap but, you know, burgeoning country like, you know, Colombia has totally reduced its crime in the past 5 years. Nobody realizes that. And so it was in stages that you started doing things. You got practice doing design outside of the conception of a job. Then you started doing moving, and now you started reaching out to, you realized you could communicate with people across continents. So you started doing this podcast. Who's been on your podcast?
Steve Case, Jason Fried, Ryan Holiday, Laura Roeder, Dan Ariely's coming on soon. You're on the podcast, Tucker Max.
Yeah, so Steve Case, okay, the practically the biggest popularizer of the internet from 1993, okay, one of the co-founders of AOL, you got him on your podcast as a multi-billionaire. So how'd you get him on your podcast?
I emailed him.
Yeah, you emailed him. So you didn't think to yourself, boy, wouldn't it be great to have Steve Case on, but I could never get him. How long did it take you to write that email?
I might have spent 5 minutes on it. I might have taken some time to really get the words right and run it past a friend. Actually, I got that idea from Robbie Abed, who I think that you've probably met before from Fire Me, I Beg You.
Yeah, Robbie literally chased me down. Robbie is a doer. He like took the train, I don't know, from Boston. I had a house in between Boston and New York. Took the train. I said, be at this one cafe at this one time. I didn't think he'd show up. He called me and said, I'm at that cafe. So I said, well, just come over to my house. And I put him on my podcast. So that guy is a doer. You got to do things. You can't think about things. But you would never, in your entire life, you never would have thought to yourself, well, I'm going to quit my job right now and move from Omaha, Nebraska to Columbia and get Steve Case on my podcast. Because it doesn't happen like that. You do things in little bits and pieces. You start off small and you get bigger and bigger. But yeah, it's doing, not thinking.
Yeah. And I totally get that. But I guess for me, it was there were so many different moments of really deep fear and things that I had thought about doing that I really put off. Like, it took me a long time of thinking about moving to Columbia to actually finally go ahead and do it. And I'm trying to figure out
I would hope so. There are drug lords raping and massacring people in Columbia. It's not a light decision, but you did it. You thought about it and you did it. And some things take 5 minutes. Some things take a little practice. You had to do a starter city first, like San Francisco. And then Columbia, which is not really that much different than San Francisco. a lot of drug wars in San Francisco also. Raping and pillaging.
So another thing that I think you're really known for is just being extremely open and extremely honest and extremely vulnerable in your writing. And I'm wondering, is that something that always came naturally to you? We were always that way.
I don't know. I mean, I think writing in general is a skill. And I think initially I didn't have that skill. And when I say initially, I'm talking about 20 years ago. And so I spent every day writing and reading. You have to read a lot and you have to write a lot.
Well, wait. You're talking about writing. Now, what about the part where you're about to write something very embarrassing that, or that most people would consider embarrassing and that most people would say, oh no, I shouldn't write that. And then you go ahead and do it. What about that part? Or is that just invisible to you?
That's invisible to me because the people who can't believe, because that's writing. Real writing is about honesty. So Bill, that's why I diverted it into, when you asked that question, I answered maybe I took a leap, but writing skill really is all about digging deeper until you hit that vein of honesty inside yourself. If it doesn't bleed, it doesn't lead. So most writing that's out there, like when you read posts on all these different blogging sites, most writing out there is not really that good writing. Like, they might have interesting ideas. There might be interesting idea-ing, but there's not really good writing. Writing is about being honest. It's not about having good ideas. It's about telling a good story and being honest. Even a fictional story has to have truth in it. So that's good writing. So all the people who are like shocked by transparency, they're just simply not used to seeing writing. Like real writing is about you know, being transparent and open and having a conversation with the world that's real and not fake.
Well, was there ever a time where you were writing something and you thought, oh, I shouldn't write this, I shouldn't publish this because X, Y, Z, and then you decided to, or?
Well, there's a two-part question. The first part is, there's lots of times I want to write something, but I will never write something. I have no problem hurting myself, but I will not do something that hurts someone else, because I think that's bad writing. When you write out of like anger or maliciousness, you know, if you're hurting someone else, there's no point. And it's not good writing. It's not, because anytime you feel anger about something, about someone else, it's really because the honest thing is that you're really afraid of something inside of yourself. So that's what you have to address in your writing. And that's what I mean by building the writing skill, to recognize that those angers or those times when you're hurting someone else, it's really more about who you are and being honest about that. So sometimes I'll stop myself and say, you know, that's not being fair to someone else, and I won't publish it. But what you're really asking, I think, is there any time I ever wrote something that was so embarrassing about myself that I really wondered whether or not I should write it? And the answer is no. I have no problem with that.
We're going to take a quick break. I don't remember everything about Boy Scouts, but I do remember that they always told me to be prepared. And I didn't listen at first, but eventually I learned that they were actually right. Just when it seemed like I had something finished, I'd realize I forgot something. It's really stressful, and I just end up wasting energy fixing broken stuff. And that's why every time I record this here podcast, I have a checklist. I make sure I have a backup internet connection, I've got my mic and my notes, and I have a glass of water. And it gives me the confidence to move forward and focus entirely on making the best show that I can. WP Engine knows having a checklist helps you focus. They've put together an extremely useful ebook, WP Engine's Ultimate Pre-Launch Checklist for WordPress Sites. It's full of checklists for launching your WordPress site with confidence. They've got checklists for design, SEO, legal, security, server migration, and a bunch more. If you work with WordPress sites at all, you gotta download WP Engine's Ultimate Pre-Launch Checklist for WordPress Sites free at wpengine.com/pre. That's wpengine.com/pre.
So when you, I mean, you kind of went from making millions of dollars to losing it and then doing the same thing again. At what point during that period of time did you start talking about that?
I think around 2010, just not that long, 6 years ago, 2010, I was just getting so sick of like going through this up and down roller coaster process. And I had no one to talk to about it. Like I wasn't really talking to anybody about it who would understand. So I just decided I was going to write about it and talk about it with everyone. And at the time, I had been writing already for about 8 years to the financial world. I was more of like a financial writer initially. And before that, I had worked at HBO. I was a different kind of writer. But I was a financial writer from 2002 to, let's say, I don't know, to even now to some extent, but really till 2010 or till 2009. And I just kept seeing all this BS being written by financial writers. Like they all pretended to know something. Nobody knew anything. That's why the financial crisis happened. There was like nobody around to tell us, hey, don't do this. And I knew everybody. I mean, maybe there's like one or two random people who were making a lot of money, but 99.9% of people lost money, which is why it was a crisis. And I was just sick of the BS. And not only that, I was losing money. So I was like, here's how it really is.
Was there a particular moment when that happened?
No, because even before then, I take it back. It wasn't just 2010. Even before then, I was writing a column for the print Financial Times, you know, the London-based Financial Times. And I was pretty honest in that column, although, you know, most people, nobody reads the newspaper, the print newspaper, so nobody ever read that column. But I was already starting to be, you know, to state my opinions and state the reality even in 2000. I started that column in 2004.
So what do you think, there was any period of time where maybe you were having thoughts about these things, about writing about these things, and then you held yourself back and didn't do that writing?
No, I honestly don't think there was. I mean, if you had asked me in 2005, would I have written about a day or a year when I lost $1 million? No, I wouldn't have even thought about it. It wasn't like I said to myself, boy, I really should write about this, and then I was too scared. I just wouldn't have thought to write about it because nobody was writing like that in the financial world. So it wasn't even like a consideration. But once I decided that, oh my God, this whole entire world is filled with BS, I decided, okay, no problem. I'm just going to start writing about this stuff because this is the truth and people should know what the truth is.
And if I look back at everything that you've done, you know, you went to school to be for computer engineering, you ended up doing stuff in finance, you were a hedge fund manager, you started a VC, now you're an author. These are like really disparate interests. And I think that there's a lot of people out there who, I get emails from people who are like, gosh, I have all these different interests and I don't know which one to pursue. And my answer to them is kind of like, pursue all of them. But was there any time where you ever thought to yourself like, oh gosh, I should really focus on this thing instead of that, or was it difficult for you to follow disparate interests?
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes it's difficult, but I like Warren Buffett's advice on this. So Warren Buffett says, list your top 25 things that you want to do in life. So you want to be an author, you want to play the piano, you want to be a DJ, you want to be a billionaire, you want to be a day trader. You list the top 25 things you want to do in life. You want to be a parent. And now you have this list of 25. Take the bottom 20 and put them to your right, and take the top 5 and put them to your left. Never, ever again look at the bottom 20. And the reason is, it's a very subtle kind of reason. The reason is not because you don't really want to do these things. They're in your top 25 things. Out of all the thousands of things you could want to do in the world, these are in your top 20 of your top 25. So his point is, every time you do any of those things, because you do really want to do them, they will distract you from the top 5. So it's really important to do that 5-25 rule.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you mentioned Warren Buffett. I used to jog by his house. I lived down the street from him for a few years. Yeah,
he's got a small little house.
Yeah, I used to walk right by there and, you know, look through the hedges and But then I was, you know, the more I read about him, the more I realized, like, oh, he kind of seemed to have the same philosophy of choosing himself, or
he totally chose himself.
Yeah, I mean, one example, just like, okay, he could have worked on Wall Street or something in New York, and he decided, oh no, I'm just gonna go live in Omaha, where I'm from.
He did work. He did work on Wall Street in New York, and he quit, and you know, life became a lot better for him.
What are some other ways that you feel like he chose himself? I mean, I know that, like, he did his own taxes. He had a really small staff.
Well, I think if you look at how he started one of the very first hedge funds, right? Like, let's say in the mid-50s. And if you look at the way he chose himself there, he didn't just go work for, I don't know, his daddy's brokerage firm or any other company. He was like a little kid, and he looked even younger than he was. And he worked literally out of his living room and would knock on the doors of his neighbors' houses and say, would you give me $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 to invest? And he started his first fund with $110,000. And he had a very unique fee structure. So nobody else in the world had a fee structure like that at that point. And he kind of defined his own rules every step of the way. Do you know, there's a story about him. He always found very unusual stocks to buy. He wouldn't buy, like, you know, in today's day and age, if he was starting out, he wouldn't buy Google or Amazon or any of these well-known stocks that are in the paper. He would buy these little-known stocks where you couldn't even find the shares. So he would go drive up to the town where the company was, and he'd put up signs, like, in the local store, hey, if anyone owns shares of this local company, can you please call me and I'll buy them from you? And he'd just sit in the hotel, his little motel room, and wait for people to call him. So he really kind of blazed his own path. I mean, we could go through every decade of his career and see how he chose himself. You know, another example is, here's a guy who's worth $50 billion, and you would think he would have, he kind of has 40,000 employees with Berkshire Hathaway, but really he just has, I think, about less than 10 people in his office, and the guy plays bridge, online bridge all day, with Bill Gates, no less. So he kind of is a great example of showing that it's important to have downtime and to be a little bit lazy. And that's how you know, people say, oh no, well, Warren Buffett reads a book a day. Yeah, he also plays bridge for 8 hours a day. So relax, everybody. He's not like working that hard.
And actually, the irony of my own story is that my father worked for a Berkshire Hathaway company for 37 years in the exact same job, you know, got to like middle management or something.
What division?
National Indemnity, the insurance company. It's like mass transit insurance.
Yeah. So National Indemnity, correct me if I'm wrong, but Warren Buffett bought that in, like, I don't know, 1965 or 1966. It was one of his first purchases that he used, that he bought with Berkshire Hathaway stock. So that was another clever thing he did. He bought this tiny little textile company in, I don't know, Maine or wherever. And he used that stock to buy small banks and insurance companies. Nobody was thinking of stuff like that then. He was like the first mini conglomerate.
Yeah, there seems to be like this theme of kind of ignoring the defaults that are out there in front of you in life. You know, it wasn't just like going looking at what was available to trade and saying, oh, well, you know, this is what I have. He like was going out there and looking for opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, that's what he does. And, you know, that's what a lot of successful people do. They don't, you know, as Robert Frost says, they take the road less traveled, or the one less traveled.
And while I have you here as a podcast host myself, I definitely have a lot of selfish questions for you about your podcast. And you're one of the most prepared interviewers I've ever heard. Like, the examples that you have are always, you just always have tons of great examples that are right on the tip of your brain and stuff. How is it that what's your process for preparing for a podcast interview?
Well, I usually, let's say I'll just pick an example. Like, I just interviewed, let's take the example, Jewel, who is a singer I interviewed recently. And
that was a fantastic show.
Thank you very much. And I didn't know anything about Jewel. I had never really, she kind of came out during a time when that style of music wasn't my style, wasn't the kind that I enjoyed listening to. And so I didn't really know much about her. And so I did several things. A, I read her memoir, of course. I read her book of poetry. I listened to her music. I read the lyrics of her songs because, you know, songwriters are writers. That's where they pour their emotions and their heart and even their memoir into, in addition to writing a memoir. I watched other interviews she gave, which was very critical because you don't want her to deliver the same canned responses to you that she gave to other people. And, you know, someone who does a lot of interviews, they're used to giving those same responses. Not her fault, just that's how people do it. And then I tried to think of what was I insanely curious about? Like, I don't want to interview someone unless I'm really curious about some part of their life or like what, you know, something I might've done differently than or that I want to learn from or that I think, you know, not only do I want to learn from, but I want to get better from. And so I just really think hard about what issues do I want to get better from? So I interviewed recently, and this podcast hasn't been released yet, Chuck Klosterman. So not everybody knows who he is, but he just wrote a book called What If We're All Wrong, about how wrong, you know, predictions are and science usually is. And, you know, so many things we usually change our opinions on every 20 to 100 years. But he's written 9 books. He's a big cultural critic. He writes music criticism, film criticism, and so on. And so I was talking to another guy who interviewed him, and that podcaster was telling me he was really curious about how Chuck Klosterman viewed his own role in society as a cultural critic. I didn't care about that at all. What I was more interested in, and in fact insanely curious about, was here's a guy who listens to music all day, watches movies all day, watches TV all day, gets to write about it, and gets paid insane amounts of money to write about it. That sounds like the dream job. So I was insanely curious how he got that job. And for me, it was a totally different kind of interview than I'm sure he's ever done before.
Now, when you're reading somebody's work, how is it that you are parsing that work? I'm sure that it's, do you read linearly? Do you read a book from front to back, or do you have a certain way of reading a book?
I read a book from front to back. You know, usually the way the author intended it, I read it that way. And then I sometimes highlight things that are interesting to me, but I rarely look back on those highlights because right there when you're in the interview, you're not going to really be able to look at the things you highlighted. It's just, you know, I usually try to read things as close as possible to the podcast, so everything's still in my short-term memory, as well as, you know, hasn't really made the transition to my long-term memory yet. And the things that stand out the most in my memory are the ones that I'm probably going to ask about.
And those things that are then in your memory that you then mention off the cuff in the podcast, are those written down or are those strictly off the tip of your brain?
Off the tip of my brain. I remember one time I was interviewing Adam Grant, who wrote the book Give and Take.
Just listened to that one today.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
He wrote the book Originals. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. So I interviewed him about both Give and Take and Originals, and he was surprised. I was quoting the acknowledgments to him because I had a question about the acknowledgments, and he was surprised about that. But it's usually just things I'm curious about while I'm reading, and I don't write them down because there's no time to really look at them during the interview.
So that was strictly from memory, your quoting of the acknowledgments.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how you picked up that level of memory.
Well, again, if you ask me now what was in the acknowledgments, I can't remember. Like, I forget. Like, it was in short-term memory because I had just read the book. But I don't know. When I was younger, I was a competitive tournament chess player, and memory plays a large role in chess. So perhaps I developed some skills from that.
Mm-hmm. So you've been practicing your memory?
Yeah, and I'm also a heavy reader.
Do you think you've gotten any better at that level of memory?
I've definitely gotten worse. I'm older now, so like I would never be able to play. I would never be able to remember, for instance, chess games like I did back when I was 18 years old.
I'm also surprised that you're able to just pick up the books and read them straight through. As somebody who, like myself, I can only read the part that I'm curious about. Like the same way that you have a question about the person that you're interviewing on the podcast, I have a question about the book. And so if I need to go to chapter 5 first, then I'm going to chapter 5. I'm surprised.
Well, it depends on the book. It depends how the book's written. Like if someone's writing a memoir and they're writing about, oh, my great grandparents moved here from Ireland in 1837, I'm not as much interested in that. So I might make, I don't usually skip sections, but I might skip sections where I think they're just following some kind of memoir format that someone told them to do, but it's not really relevant to the actual memoir. But in general, I read things, you know, straight through.
How many hours of preparation would you say that you have for, say, the Jewel show?
10.
Yeah. And
so I would say for every hour of podcast, I probably do 10 hours of prep, give or take two.
And how did you end up? I really like how you've branched out of just the sort of entrepreneur space. You know, you've had Coolio on the show. That was a fantastic interview. Jewel, that was a fantastic interview. How did you, I guess Coolio is the one from like earlier on where I'm wondering, like, how did you, because I find that branching out to people in, people in entertainment and show business, I don't really know how to reach them.
Well, I think, I mean, I've actually very rarely had businessmen or entrepreneurs on my podcast. I mean, I had Steve Case, just like you. But I haven't really had, I would say maybe 10% of my podcast has been business oriented. I'm really much more interested in peak performance. So someone who reached the pinnacle of their career or writes about how to achieve peak performance.
Okay, so how did you get in touch with Coolio?
Gosh, to be honest with that one, I can't remember how I got in touch with him.
He just like has an, I don't think he just has like a website with an email address on there that you can just.
There, he might. I mean, he had a cookbook that he was trying to promote. You know, Coolio is a cook.
Okay.
In addition to being a rapper. Let me see.
This is definitely something I try to do is I try to look out for like when Steve Case or when Robbie told me to have Steve Case on the show, it was because Steve Case had a new book coming out and the timing would be perfect. Right. So I've learned since then to look out for when people have, something going on and that's the perfect time then to ask them. So that might've been the case with Coolio.
Actually, here's what I just did. I was just searching Coolio through my Gmail and I saw that I had mentioned that I had Coolio on my podcast to, Ernest Cline. Do you know who he is?
I don't.
He wrote the book Ready Player One, which is a science. It's one of the top science fiction novels out there, and it's going to be made into a movie. And I wrote to him in August of 2015, and I wrote, you know, please come on my podcast. And I see that Coolio is mentioned in this email because that's how I saw this email. And I just re-forwarded it to him. So I just asked Ernest Cline on again while searching for Coolio while talking to you. But let me see where I asked Coolio. But this is what I mean about doing something like that. That cost me 2 seconds of time in
so
the middle of
following up on the email.
I re-forwarded it. You know, I did the re-forward.
I mean, you didn't say anything. They don't take offense to that type of follow up.
No, I wrote please with an exclamation point.
Oh, okay.
I used to have volunteers who were kind of like volunteer producers for my podcast. Who would find out how to get a hold of somebody, and they reached out to Coolio's publicists and publishers and managers and agents, and somehow this one guy found his way to Coolio and booked it for me.
And how did you get Jewel?
Well, now my podcast is has a big enough audience that Jewel's publishing company for her memoir, they reached out to me.
Oh, that's great.
In fact, another real high profile name that I'm excited about just reached out today. Her publishing company reached out today, and I'm excited about this one. And she'll be coming on in the next week.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. I'll start wrapping it up, I guess. What's the biggest compromise that you've had to make to get where you are?
Well, I probably make much less money than I could have if I just wore a suit and worked on Wall Street every day with all the other scumbags.
And this is another thing I always ask people: is when have you left money on the table in exchange for something that was of value to you? And that sounds like one of those one of those instances. What do you feel like you get that you value when you are leaving that money on the table?
I'm offered jobs worth millions of dollars all the time, and I leave that on the table because I'm lazy and I like to sit at home and talk with my friends in Colombia.
And what was the last book that you've...
That sounds very drug-related, but it's true.
I mean, I don't even think about drugs here in Colombia. I don't know.
How's our Colombian friends doing? It's like a line from The Sopranos.
I haven't watched The Sopranos, and I haven't watched, what's the one everybody's watching, Narcos. I haven't watched that yet either. What's the last book that you read that changed the way that you saw something?
Almost every book I read changes the way I see things. Like if I read even a fiction book by a really good writer, there's always lines that I highlight where I think, oh, that's really interesting.
How about like one that really just like blew your brain apart?
I mean, there are a couple of books like that where you feel like your IQ is going up just by reading this book. So for instance, it's hard to say the author's name, but I'll try to say it. The book is called Sapiens. Do you know that book?
Yeah, I read that one.
Yeah, that's an amazing book, right?
Yeah, I think the thing that was the most useful for me out of that was just this idea that humanity is based off shared beliefs and that like money is a religion and entrepreneurship is a religion right now and
I like how you said how the invention of agriculture basically ruined society, you know, 10,000 years ago, but that now that one thing that's interesting in society is how borders are breaking down, you know, over and over. Mm-hmm. But it was just an amazing book. That book blew my mind.
Do you make your bed?
I do, yeah.
And have you always made your bed?
No, but now that I live in like Airbnb, I only live in Airbnbs, and I feel like, I don't know, it's just a thing to do. Like, it's not my house, so I just want to keep it as... If you keep things clean along the way, you have to do less work at the end since I'm moving around and stuff.
So it's recent and it's kind of like a politeness thing. Is it any sort of a personal hygiene thing for you?
No. I mean, when I was a kid, I always, I'm not necessarily an organized or clean person, but I don't like to work unless it's a very clean environment. And so... Sometimes I have to do it for myself, and sometimes you're married and someone else does it, or sometimes you do it for them, and you know, it just depends.
Mm-hmm. Do you tuck in the sheets when you make the bed?
No, I hate that because then my feet are uncomfortable when I sleep.
So you just flatten it all out and make it look presentable, and then you're done and you're good. But if Admiral McWilliams came in, then you would probably be in trouble.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm definitely not soldier material.
And do you have a final message to summarize what we've talked about here today?
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting things even for me to think about. Like, do I make sure I do every day, you know, do stuff every day and to move myself forward? I think always making sure you're doing little experiments every day to move yourself forward along the things you're interested in. I think that's a very useful thing to do, and I have to remember to do it myself. So then that's how I quote-unquote choose myself.
And where can people get more of you?
JamesAltucher.com or the book Choose Yourself, or I'm James Altucher on Instagram. I'm Jay Altucher on Twitter. I'm all over the place.
Great.
My podcast, The James Altucher Show.
Yes, definitely listen to the podcast because you're a person who listens to podcasts. You probably already listened to that podcast, but anyway, go check it out if you haven't. James, thank you so much for coming to this virtual meeting of ours today.
Yes.
You're a huge hero of mine, so it was a huge honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, too. Thanks for asking me to come on.
Your designer has been lying to you. Design doesn't have to be a mystery. Get $100 off any pay upfront package of my flagship visual design course, D4H Video. Just go to cadavy.net/video and use the code LOVEIT on any pay upfront package. I hope that conversation with James Altucher helps you listen to your own ideas. I hope it helps you take small actions to get started. And if you do any writing, and I think everyone should, I hope it helps make your writing more open and honest. And remember, you can get Choose Yourself at katavi.net/choose. That was such a valuable conversation for me, and it actually got more valuable after listening to it the third or fourth time. So it's certainly worth a re-listen. But if you want to hear more about really investing in yourself, I think you'd also really like the very first episode of Love Your Work with Jason Fried. Hear about the early days of 37 Signals, now Basecamp. How did they fight their assumptions to create a truly original company?
We weren't trying to be different. We just realized that we were. Let's take a shot. Like, what do we have to lose here? What we actually have to lose is not being ourselves. And that is a bigger loss than being yourself and not getting traction. Like, if we were trying to act like everyone else, then we weren't really being ourselves, and that's the loss.
And if you appreciate all the work that goes into making this show, there are a couple of ways you can help support it. One is to subscribe. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Just hit the subscribe button. Another is to rate the show on iTunes. Just go to katavi.net/iTunes and click on write a review and click on the star rating. You don't even have to write a review. It just takes a couple of seconds. And do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to katavi.net/reading, sign up, and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Katavi. The theme music for the show is More Streets, performed by Spiderflower. Love Your Work is a production of Katavi, Inc.